It's the third Monday of the month, and so I have as my guest Dr. Fred Harvey. Good morning, Dr. Harvey.
Good morning.
And so I said we're going from irritable bowel to vindictive bowel, because that's certainly what I see happening among my clients.
Oh, yes. It's a serious problem. The vindictive nature of these problems is that it affects everyone, and it could really impair your ability to function in the real world. It inhibits your ability to think. It's so bad sometimes.
When your gut is running your life, then it will certainly impair your ability to function. And I know a lot of people walk into my office and they say they have a diagnosis of IBS. And I've always said that IBS stands for IB stupid, because it just means the gastroenterologists weren't able to figure out what was going on. Am I being too harsh?
No. This is the big drawback of Western medicine. The big problem is that it's got limitations on its ability to look beyond. It's a disease-focused paradigm that we're working in, and when you look at disease and try to describe disease, it's the only term you can think of. The problem is that IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, is not a disease. In fact, its definition lands it right in the realm where you and I work. It's a chronic functional disorder manifested by alteration in bowel habits and recurrent abdominal pain and bloating. Irritable bowel syndrome is a symptom complex influenced by a variety of physiologic determinants from gut to brain and back. And that is from Ferry, the practical guide to care of the medical patient. It's a definition that is lacking in the main thing that Western medicine is designed to need, and that is a true diagnosis. It's a description. And so they're hampered in that they can't think about it, because it doesn't have a linear answer. There's no just drug to treat this problem that they have a distinct diagnosis for.
What we want to do is help the listeners understand the term syndrome itself. You know, if you've got a runny nose and you're sneezing, then you could say it's hay fever. But in fact, if you have a runny nose and you're sneezing and your throat is sore and you're feeling kind of flat, we call that syndrome a cold. It's a collection of symptoms that go together that define a particular pathway.
And if you add a little cough, a really deep cough, to that same syndrome that doesn't seem all that bad, like hay fever or cold, it could actually be whooping cough, pertussis.
Right.
So a syndrome is just an indistinct group of symptoms, and that's what, unfortunately, and this is what hampers them, and I do feel for them in their inability to deal with this. The gastroenterologist is left with this symptom complex. It's not the realm they can work in, so they can't really help people very well.
Well, you know, when we think about the gut, it's the tube inside the tube. And the nature of our gut is it's so separate from the rest of our body until all the foods are broken down into their component parts that you could actually have your whole digestive tract in a backpack, because it's completely isolated from the rest of your body until such time as those nutrients start to pour into your bloodstream. But one of the problems is that the nervous system that regulates the gut is very involved in the rest of your body. And the profound research that has been done on the relationship of the nervous system, which is a special branch of the nervous system that affects the gut, says why, you know, some people say my bowel is stressed. When I have stress, my bowel doesn't behave. So when we look at what the gut is there to do, you know, the Chinese medicine talks about separating the clean from the unclean, that the digestive tract is designed to take out of food that which serves you and for you to eliminate that which doesn't serve you. And so without your digestive tract, which you should respect and salute every day, you couldn't blink your eyes, you couldn't walk across the room, you couldn't be listening to this fabulous community radio station. Your gut provides you the ability to take the food that's on your plate and transform it into you. You know, I've often said that the analogy that's often used, that gasoline in the car is like food on your plate. If you get poor quality gasoline, your engine pings. And if you get poor quality food, your body doesn't run as well. But that's really a lousy analogy, because the gasoline never becomes the car. but the food becomes you, literally becomes you. So when you take in that plate of food, and those of you that are regular listeners to No Nonsense Nutrition know I start Monday morning with a container full of fruit, and this morning it's blueberry and happily the of-the-season mulberries and papaya and pineapple together with my plain Greek yogurt. So I'm taking in that food, and right now my stomach and the enzymes in my stomach are starting to churn that food, because the stomach actually moves as we digest. It's sort of a second set of teeth in the fact that it chomps the food up and turns it into mush. We call it chyme. And then that fruit and yogurt is going to go down into my small intestine, and other enzymes that the pancreas secretes are going to work on it. And they're going to break those foods down into proteins, into amino acids, fats into fatty acids, and carbohydrates into glucose. And then and only then can I use those nutrients in order to support both my body functions and the building, maintenance, and repair of my body.
You can understand that then, since this tube inside the tube is so critical, it starts with the lips, the teeth. Every piece of the digestion has to be working well to make your bowel be able to assimilate the food and deal with it appropriately. So you have to chew well. If you just swallow it whole, your stomach has a whole heck of a lot more work to do. I like to think of the stomach as a pastry bag or an icing bag that's got the little tip on the end of it, and it's really squishy. And as you work the material inside the bag, that's what the stomach's doing, a little bit comes out the end. And it does. It trickles out at about a teaspoon every minute and slowly comes into your small bowel, giving it the small bowel a chance to take that acidic stuff from the stomach, neutralize it with bicarb from the pancreas, which then allows the mix of bile and enzymes from the pancreas and the gallbladder to further digest the food in a different pH environment. And then it keeps going down further, where nutrients are extracted in the small bowel, and then the bacteria go to work and take care of the rest of the debris in the large bowel, and all the water is extracted, and then you have the remainder, which is, you know, not useful stuff for us, and excretory stuff that comes from our liver that we're trying to get rid of, like detoxified hormones and detoxified pesticides. So the whole process has to keep working. And you can see that if it gets bound up and you have these detoxified pesticides sitting in your bowel, that maybe some of them might be released. And pesticides alter motility. So you might get more constipated because you have pesticides slowing down the function of your bowel. And so what's really hard about it is that it's a thing that lasts for a long time. The diagnosis of irritable bowel by a Western doctor is simply a symptom-based criteria. They want to hear abdominal pain for at least 3 months, if not 6 months, and you have to get better when you have a bowel movement, and you have to have alterations in the frequency and the consistency of your stool. So you get diarrhea, constipation, sluggish weeks, really rapid weeks, five a day, none for 5 days. And this is the kind of recurrent, very disruptive pattern that your bowel takes that totally takes control of your life. And at any age, too. There are one of the worst ones I've seen recently is a five-year-old girl that had been suffering with crampiness, constipation for 2 years of her small life. And she'd been to specialist pediatricians at specialist children's hospitals and was getting absolutely no results whatsoever, except for giving antifreeze laxative, which kept her moving, but she still had the abdominal pain and the bad moods and everything else that went along with the syndrome. So it's unfortunate, but people just, Western medicine is stuck with very minimal things to do, which is symptom control. That's what it even says it in the literature. We're treating symptoms, and it doesn't work for everyone because they're not looking at the bigger picture of how the bowel functions.
Years ago, there was a commercial on television that showed two ladies leaning over their communal fence in their backyard. And one of the ladies in the commercial said, "Madge, are you regular?" And so the emphasis was simply on whether you were having a bowel movement every day. But the thing is, that was the very first time it ever got talked about on television, other than a toilet joke. we have to realize that this has become a subject that is often taboo. Granted, it doesn't make for good cocktail party conversation, but we spend so much time talking about what goes in and so little time understanding what comes out. And so when we begin to understand that this digestive function really is a measurement of your health, there is not a single system in your body that is not connected to your bowel in terms of function. So if you have a skin condition like eczema or psoriasis or acne, I guarantee you it's related to your bowel. If you have anxiety and sleeplessness, I'll guarantee you it's connected to your bowel. If you have nausea repeatedly, I guarantee you it's connected to your bowel. So what we have to do is change the perception that somehow the bowel is not connected to everything else. You know, one of the questions that I give to people when they come into clinic for their first appointment is, do you have a bowel movement every day? Well, it seems like a pretty simple question. Well, there should be two answers, yes and no. But it is not uncommon for me to get as an answer, well, pretty much. Do you have a bowel movement every day? Most of the time. Do you have a bowel movement every day? Well, yeah, kind of. None of those are the right answer. The answer is yes or no. And there is nothing normal about not having a bowel movement every day. It may be common, but it is not normal. And so one of the symptoms that cumulatively supports the diagnosis of IBS is fewer than three bowel movements a week or more than three bowel movements a day. Either one of those are hard or lumpy stools, loose, mushy, watery stools, straining during a bowel movement, urgency, the point at which you've got to run for the toilet because you have urgency. Anytime we have a feeling of an incomplete bowel movement, you're done, but you're not done. If you're passing mucus, if you're having abdominal fullness and bloating and swelling, all of those symptoms can be supportive symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. And so it's not uncommon when you go to a gastroenterologist that what they do is order a colonoscopy. You know, the joke in our office for GI guys is they scope from above, they scope from below, they meet in the middle, and they make a lot of dough. Yeah, we get a giggle out of that, but we're incredibly thankful for the gastroenterologist because I know I have one client in my practice, and she went in for her baseline gastroenterology colonoscopy exam at age 50, and they discovered a cancer that unlikely would have been discovered for years otherwise, and her life was saved as a result of that. And so we want to understand that when GI guys do their work, the majority of their work is geography studies, endoscopies from the top and colonoscopies from the bottom. But what is not uncommon, at least not in my practice, is they will simply say, well, you just need to have some more fiber, or you need to take these probiotics. But they don't go any further with trying to discover if there's a bad critter living in the condo, as we say it in our office, meaning that there's a parasite, a bacteria, or a yeast that has become disproportionate in the bowel in its population and as a result is causing chronic irritation. Nor do I see gastroenterologists, at least not in this town, looking at things like food sensitivities, which can greatly change the motility or the rate at which material moves through the bowel. Remember, if the material moves through the bowel too fast, then you have diarrhea. If the material moves through the bowel too slow, then you have constipation. Well, why would material move too fast through the bowel? Because the body is saying, get this out of here. Get this out of here. And that creation of diarrhea can often come from a food sensitivity. So the place that I fault the GI guys is when they don't look at all the critters that are living in the condo and they don't look at the food sensitivities.
Yeah, Western approach, and I do appreciate Western medicine. I'm a trained board-certified internist and geriatrician. I love Western medicine. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else with an acute illness. We have the best illness care in the world here. However, when you look at something that's not an illness, it's actually a functional disturbance, and you're left with the Western approach of looking at disturbances in motility, in other words, movement, fast or slow, diarrhea, constipation, or disturbances in sensation, I have cramps, or I don't have cramps, or disturbances in secretion, mucus in the stools. These are the three areas of concern that gastroenterologists actually end up looking at. And so they approach it by treating the symptom of fast motility or slow. So if you have constipation, they give you a laxative or a bowel stimulant like lubiprostone. Or if they have a problem with diarrhea, slow it down with an anti-diarrheal medicine, an antispasmodic for the spasmy cramps, and then really it is not much of an answer for the mucus secretion. I don't think I've never heard
of anybody even acknowledging it.
Yeah, I've seen it in the literature, but nobody really talks about it. They mention it as a symptom, but so when you're looking at it as a not disease, the search then in diagnostic terms for the gastroenterologist becomes a disease of rule out. So they rule out other more serious conditions. So they do the colonoscopy to rule out a cancer because, you know, there could be a cancer that's causing a slowing or a more rapid bowel movement, etc. And other things that have been suggested, and it's a very narrow group. It's a look at a lactose intolerance and maybe look at celiac disease. So they did look at a food sensitivity in a way, and the lactose intolerance is not really a food sensitivity, but just intolerance of that sugar. But so,
let's stop right there, because when clients come in and they say I'm lactose intolerant, I say, do you eat cheese? You know, that's my first question, mm-hmm. because for the most part, cheese doesn't have any lactose in it.
Right.
And so when they say, oh, no, I can't eat any dairy products at all, then you know that lactose isn't the problem. The problem is casein. It's right. One of the proteins that's in the milk. If you have fresh cheese, like mozzarella or cottage cheese, ricotta cheese or pot cheese, farmer's cheese, all the fresh cheeses, those fresh cheeses contain lactose, as does yogurt. But when you have hard, dry cheeses, the Parmesan, the Romano, the five-year-old aged cheddar, the drier, harder cheeses, all of the lactose has been biologically changed and becomes lactic acid. That's why cheese tastes tart. So if you react to milk, ice cream, and yogurt, but you don't react to dry cheeses, well, then you're lactose intolerant. And you want to understand, lactose is a disaccharide. It's a sugar, two sugars hooked together, just like the sucrose in your sugar bowl at home. And there are a particular group of bacteria. They're called anaerobic bacteria. Anaerobic bacteria make up the largest amount of bacteria in your bowel. But there's a special group of anaerobes that can only multiply if they have these disaccharides or these twin sugars. So the second that you put in sucrose, white table sugar, or lactose, milk sugar, these bacteria start to multiply and you get bloated. You can actually watch somebody's belly grow. It looks like a 5 months pregnancy in about 40 minutes. And so if you're suspicious that you have lactose intolerant, you can double check it by just getting up in the morning and instead of drinking a glass of milk, just put a teaspoon of white table sugar in your mouth on an empty stomach. And if your belly grows over the next 20 to 40 minutes, then you can pretty well be sure that you've got overgrowth of small bowel bacteria that need to be controlled. And unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because they're often misused, the one thing that does control those bacteria is antibiotics. This is an appropriate use of antibiotics to kill back the overgrowth of small bowel bacterial overgrowth or small intestine bacterial overgrowth that happens that causes the bloating. And the thing that makes a difference in this particular condition is that you will be bloated but not necessarily gassy. It would seem like if you were that bloated, you'd be really gassy at the same time. But very many individuals who have lactose and sucrose intolerance may be bloated but not be gassy. So that's a differentiating diagnosis.
Yes. So thinking through things like that is the functional approach, because that was really a clear description you gave of how the digestion of sugar or the not digestion of sugar functions to create symptoms in each individual. And some people have absolutely no problem with sugars because they have great intact disaccharidase enzymes all through their bowel. But once we start damaging the bowel, all bets are off.
How would you damage the bowel?
Well, for example, lactose intolerance may occur after a severe gastrointestinal illness, a bacterial food poisoning, a terrible virus, some insult to the gut may actually destroy your disaccharidase enzyme, and you may develop lactose intolerance after that insult in later life rather than being born with a deficiency.
You know, I've talked before about the fact that it's probably not a week that goes by that somebody comes in and says, I had that 24-hour stomach bug. And, you know, I have to turn to all of them and say, there is no such thing as a 24-hour stomach bug. You had food poisoning.
Right.
And they're like, what? And I go, yeah, you had food poisoning. Oh, well, my husband and my son and I all ate at the table together, and they didn't get sick. That doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You can have a chicken, and you eat the left side of the chicken, and the rest of your family eats the right side of the chicken, and there can be bacteria on one side that's not on the other side.
Another possibility is that the person that got sick actually took a proton pump inhibitor and reduced their stomach acid and didn't kill off the bacteria that were on the food. And the other people didn't take that, and so they had a good first defense for a bacterial infection.
Well, the regular listeners of No Nonsense Nutrition know that those stomach acid suppressors greatly increase your risk of food poisoning. And so, granted, we want to get rid of GERD or gastroesophageal reflux disease or heartburn or sour risings or...
But suppressing acid isn't the way.
Suppressing acid may provide symptom relief, but it doesn't provide solution. And actually can create a very typical digestive disease condition and create more inflammatory bowel.
So when we look at it functionally, it's a really complex issue. We break it down to a lot of different areas. We look at altered digestion and absorption, which we've been talking about. The mucosal barrier integrity, is the lining of the gut stable? Has it been damaged?
And let me stop you right there, Dr. Harvey, because, you know, as taking an 81 milligram aspirin every day has become more and more popular.
Yes.
The first thing we want to understand is there is no research. I want to underline and put it in capital letters, no research about 81 milligrams of aspirin. The research was all based on 2 81 milligram aspirin tablets, or half of a regular aspirin. Regular aspirins are 325 milligrams. But what happens is, in addition to seeing eye bleeds way more often. You know how when you look at somebody and they got a big red blotch in the white of their eye and they've ruptured a blood vessel? I have seen that much more frequently in the last 3 years than I've ever seen it historically in my practice from individuals that are on this low-dose aspirin every day. But secondarily, when you're putting in this aspirin every day, every day, every day, or you're taking ibuprofen or naproxen or acetaminophen on a daily basis for pain management, you know, whether it's your arthritis or your aching back, I see way more damage to the lining of the gut as a result of this. And I have been, over the last year, recommending to my clients that are taking 81 milligrams of aspirin every day that they would actually be better off taking a full-strength aspirin, a 325 milligram aspirin, twice a week. Because the effects of aspirin as the blood thinning effect actually lasts about 4 days. So if you take a 325 milligram aspirin every Monday, every Friday, or every Wednesday, every Sunday, whatever works in your life, you're not going to be constantly exposing the lining of the stomach and the digestive tract to the corrosive effects that aspirin, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and naproxen can have on the digestive tract. Would you comment on that and the effect on the bowel wall?
Oh, yes. Well, we know that aspirin and all these anti-inflammatory agents are associated with gastrointestinal bleeding, ulcer formation, and destruction of the barrier integrity in the gut. And many of the things, when you're doing them, taking them for maintenance of chronic pain, which is probably the result of chronic inflammation, your body is already set up for problems like those eye bleeds, because chronic inflammation leads to a barrier integrity problem in your blood vessels, endothelial dysfunction we've talked about. And so if you're having chronic inflammation, your system, entire system, is being affected. So taking those aspirins is going to, or nonsteroidals, will break down more barriers, the gut, which then leads to even more problems, because you'll have the potential for developing food sensitivities due to the leaky gut, further problems with immunity, and then microbiome or the gut flora balance will alter because you're damaging the lining of the gut, which communicates with these bacteria and creates a friendly network that is usually stable until we disrupt it somehow.
Well, I mean, you brought in probiotics in that conversation, the bacteria of the bowel. And, you know, if you watch American television, there's been certainly a surge in the last year of the number of probiotic products that
Absolutely.
Are being sold. It's really astounding. And it's wonderful that the transition has been made from functional and holistic medicine to general information about probiotics. But I'm here to tell you there is a big difference between the good, the bad, and the ugly out there.
Yes.
University of North Carolina did a remarkable study. They went to the health food store. They bought 20 bottles of probiotics, and 19 of the bottles didn't have in the bottle what it said on the label. So there is a difference in quality. You know, the very first thing that we want is a probiotic that is human sourced. And the nature of probiotics is there are two primary names, Bifidobacter bacterium and Lactobacillus acidophilus. Almost everybody's heard of Lactobacillus acidophilus because we now have Lactobacillus acidophilus in some yogurt. Remember, it's not in frozen yogurt, and it's not in things like Yoplait where they've had added gelatin in as a thickening agent. But Lactobacillus acidophilus can be present in milk, and it can be present in other dairy foods. But it is not your primary bacteria in your bowel. Your primary bacteria in your bowel is Bifidobacter bacterium. It makes up about 25% of all of the weight of the 3 to 4 pounds of bacteria you have in your gut. Yeah, you heard me right. 3 to 4 pounds of bacteria live in your gut. So if you imagine a 5-pound bag of sugar, because most of us can visualize that, you know, stub that down a little bit, and that's how much bacteria you have living in your bowel. 25% of it is bifida. In fact, in the nursing baby, 95% of their bowel will be Bifidobacter. So when you get a probiotic, you're looking for both of those bacteria. And after the name of the bacteria will be what I call the license plate number, the letters or the code numbers that indicate that this bacteria is listed in the American Registry of Cultures. So that essentially we know where this bacteria came from. The comparison that I make is to getting a dog from the pound versus getting a dog from the breeder. If you get a dog from the pound, you don't have any papers. If you get a dog from a breeder, you know who the dog's grandmother is. So when you buy bacteria that has guaranteed strain, that has the code letters and numbers after the bacteria, you're getting papers. You're at least finding out where that bacteria came from. Doesn't necessarily mean it's the best one, but it means it's better than a whole lot of other ones that are out there.
That's so true. And, you know, that brings us to maybe another thought on this. Gastroenterologists, unfortunately, don't do a lot of stool testing. Many patients come to my office and say, oh, yeah, I had that. The doctor gave me that little paper, that little cardboard thing with the three little things on it. You put a little poop on it and send it back to them. But that's not a stool test. That's just a screen for occult blood, which is a really good cancer screen, and everybody should do it over 50 periods.
Right, and we want to remind people that that is not typical of IBS.
That is not, right. Blood in your stool is a colitis or something different, and you need to get that evaluated. But we have a in functional medicine, we look at the stool, and we actually do a culture of the whole microbiome. In Western medicine, we look for illness, so we only look for the 4 major pathogens, Shigella, Campylobacter, E. coli, and
Salmonella.
And so these are really not what we're looking for to look at the microbiome family, what makes up the bulk of our bowel. And so the comprehensive stool analysis is really useful because we can look at these things that come into digestion and absorption. We can look at the enzymes and the bile salts and whether you're having fat come out in your stool and the pH and the entire family of organisms to see if you have enough Bifidobacterium, to see if you have enough Lactobacillus, or if there are unfriendly critters hanging out like Klebsiella or Proteus, which cause inflammation and disruption. It also decrease barrier integrity. And We can see if there are unwanted yeast there, candida and other things like that, which would upset the balance. And so those things all come into play in this whole symptom complex that is not even addressed by the standard Western approach, because they're not looking at function. They're just only looking for illness. They will screen you for a parasite too, but that's a small portion of this whole group of people, I think.
Well, you know, I find parasites in about 25% of the tests that I do. So that was way higher than I expected.
Yes.
Because I kind of believed that the only people that got parasites were people that went to South America or Borneo or something like that. But we have to realize that the parasites could be coming in on the box of food that came from another country.
Yes.
Or the parasites could be coming from the unwashed hands of the restaurant worker who prepared your salad. Unfortunately. So when we begin to look at the nature of yeast, parasites, and bacteria that show up in a stool study, I've been doing stool studies in the clinic now for, I'm going to say, 18 or 19 years. And I have probably seen easily thousands and thousands and thousands. I'd probably be up there in the, 5,000 to 7,000 stool studies that I've looked at over all of these years. And what's true is that just on Saturday, I got back a stool study on a client that has a yeast I never heard of before.
Really?
Yeah. Another species. Candida has about 70 subspecies.
Yes.
And so we hear about Candida albicans, but you don't hear about Candida rugosa and Candida tropicalis and all of these other ones. Parapsilosis, right? Comes from birds. For those of you that are dating birds, you want to be very careful of your hygiene.
Celery fields.
But the thing is, after all of these years of doing these studies, still, I open up a test and here's a critter, in this case a yeast, that I've never seen before.
And frankly, that's, when I started doing these stool studies years ago, I actually got scared because I saw things on there that I never thought I'd see in medicine. And I had to go and do some research and figure out what to do about these things because, we're not trained in Western medicine to do a lot of stool tests, even parasite tests.
That's right. I've learned microbiology 15 minutes at a time.
It's exactly the way it was. I mean, I had a great microbiology experience in medical school, but it didn't prepare me for looking at stool tests like this that had so much information, really valuable, very useful information that can help direct us to a solution for some of these terrible problems.
So for those of you that have been diagnosed with IB stupid or IBS, meaning that your doctor couldn't figure it out, where are you going to start? Well, the first place you're going to start is that when you have an episode, if you have diarrheal type of IBS and you have an episode, write down everything you've eaten for 24 hours before. Mm-hmm. And the next time you have an episode, write down what you've eaten for 24 hours before. What you want to understand is that there are times when a single food can be reactive enough to cause you to have an episode. And until such time as you're a documenter, you're not going to be able to track it down. And sometimes it may be a food that you eat on occasion, but not a lot of it. But in the 24 hours before the last episode, you ate it really frequently. So rather than just having bread now and then, you had a bagel for breakfast and a sandwich for lunch and pasta for dinners and cookies before you went to bed. So it may be the volume of that particular food that caused the problem for you.
Yeah, it's very true. And actually, it's interesting. Most doctors will say, hey, take some fiber to fix that problem. But there are people that really don't respond well to fiber.
Yeah, there's people that fiber can make them worse.
Yes, and it could be because of the bacterial dysbiosis or an unbalanced group of family down there or other reasons, but they can't take fiber. And so fiber is one of the first things that actually you can eliminate from the diet just to see what happens. If you haven't figured out a pattern, if you haven't found that one food that is the trigger, fiber is often a trigger. And if you just reduce it and do a low-residue diet for a few days, you may find everything calms down.
Well, and you have to remember that the single most popular fiber supplement that exists in the United States, psyllium seed husks.
Yes.
There's a lot of people that are reactive to psyllium.
Yes.
And so they take psyllium every day thinking they're going to improve the texture and volume of the bowel, and in fact, they make themselves worse.
And I just was looking at a bread yesterday, in fact, at a local health establishment, and it actually had psyllium fiber in the bread. I never thought of putting psyllium in my bread.
It's better than purified cellulose, which is nothing more than sawdust, and I've found that in high-fiber bread as well.
That's true.
Yeah, somehow eating a log was not what I was thinking of. The other thing that we want to do is realize that these stool studies are expensive. You know, these things are in the $300-plus category, and so they're not things that Dr. and I recommend randomly. The same thing is true of food sensitivity tests. They're up in the $300-plus category. And with the amount of insurance Nazis that we're dealing with today, there are so many companies that don't pay for these tests even when they're required. So I have clients that have bags of money, and I have clients that don't have any money. And we couldn't do the test if we wanted to. We have to do it by observation exclusively. But I will tell you that, after 25 years in practice, and I'm here to announce that last Saturday I celebrated my 25th anniversary of the very first class I ever did in Sarasota. Kind of amazed me that amount of time has gone by. And thanks to Radio Dave for his lovely compliment on my age this morning. But what we want to do is to realize that the changes that have happened over that period of time bring us back sometimes to the most simple. And the most simple is just adding a high-quality probiotic in. Just that alone can often reduce the amount of just discomfort that happens with irritable bowel. The second thing that I would put on the list would be digestive enzymes. Using pancreatic phase enzymes, the enzymes that support the small intestine digestion, those enzymes most often taken at the very beginning of a meal so that they're sitting in your belly waiting for the food. If I give somebody an enzyme and I give somebody a probiotic, I'll often reduce their symptoms by 30 to 60% without even knowing what kind of critters are living in their gut.
It's so true. Just giving the gut a break, so to speak. As I said, doing a low-residue diet, getting some of the fiber out, gives the motility part of your gut a break. Because with the fiber there, it has to mush and push and mush and push, and that may be irritating enough for the system and even cause a little bit of more mucosal damage because it's working so hard. And when the probiotics get in there, they talk to your bowel wall. And they talk to the inflammatory cells, dendritic cells that line the gut, and they tell them that it's okay. They set up a friendly conversation that allows the inflammatory part of the bowel to be more calm, which then reduces things like histamine and the irritation to the enteric nervous system, which is another big part of this issue. The second brain, or maybe really the first brain, is in your gut. 98% of all serotonin is created in your gut, I just read. But 67% of all neurotransmitters are created in the gut. And so if the gut is upset, you're going to have mood disturbances. And so calming that down will really help to soothe symptoms. The enzymes, again, give the pancreas a break and allow it to function a little bit less aggressively. And so adding these things in that help to balance out the way the gut works really can take the edge off very quickly and help improve function.
You know, one of the things that I use in my practice is a concentrate of immunoglobulins. Immunoglobulins are the white blood cells that your body uses to fight bad critters. So if you get exposed to a virus or you get exposed to a bacteria, IgGs, then you make IgGs in your body every day, they act like little magnets and they grab a hold of these bad critters. Well, some people don't make enough of these IgGs and IgAs and IgMs and IgDs and IgEs, all sorts of families of these immunoglobulins, but there are immunoglobulins that can be made by other animals and that we can not not by hurting the animal, but we can remove those IgGs from the other animal. In this case, the single most beautiful cows you've ever seen in your life. I mean, these are cows that you would invite to your house because they are so gorgeous with the big long eyelashes. And these cows go to the blood bank once a month and they donate their blood. And then they spin the IgGs out of their blood. And the reason their IgGs are so valuable is these cows have been inoculated with virtually every vaccine known. They've been inoculated with mumps and measles and typhoid and herpes and valley fever and, you know, yellow fever and smallpox and 100 different things. And they make all these antibodies. And what happens is when we take their serum and we spin the white blood cells out and we purify them and concentrate them, they can be given to somebody and they can help their body, the human body, capture some of these bad bacteria without necessarily knowing which ones they are. And so if I was going to put together the simplest program for somebody who had IBS, I'd give them digestive enzymes, probiotics, and extra IgGs. And in 9 out of 10 instances, I'm going to get a tremendous amount of relief. We may not completely solve the problem until we find out what their food sensitivities are and until we heal the wall of the bowel that has become leaky. You know, we use that term leaky gut. We want you to know that there aren't really holes in the wall of the bowel. That it's just simply that the membranes at the wall of the bowel allow larger molecules to pass through than should be allowed to pass through.
Well, when you get actually to the real serious end of leaky gut, there are holes. When you get a true celiac or similar kind of case,
ulcerative colitis.
Yeah, the mucosal barrier is gone. You have ulcers, you have holes. But that's not the case in somebody who just has a mild leaky gut or a yeast overgrowth or irritable bowel syndrome generally. But it's interesting, to keep the immune balanced, the gut has several layers. The mucosal barrier is covered with another kind of IgG or Ig. It's called IgA. Secretory IgA lines the entire wet skin from your nose to your anus. There are IgA molecules all over it, and these are first defense. They will grab onto little magnets. They will grab onto the bad stuff, be it foods that are reactive or bad critters, and they will basically detoxify it. It'll end up staying in the gut. In the gut lumen and get passed out rather than making it through to irritate the secondary defense system or the lymphoid tissue that lines the gut. You know, 60% of your lymphoid tissue lines your gut. It's a first defense. You don't want to get that thing ticked off. And when you do, you get symptoms. So this SIGA is hanging out there, being that first defense, keeping things calm. But when you get the barrier damage, you don't have as much of that, and so this IgG that Eve was talking about, you can take orally, takes up that response, or takes up that responsibility, and so it allows the gut to calm down because it takes that stuff away and chills the place out.
Well, and this secretory IgA, or SIGA, is something that we measure with a stool study.
Yes.
And when I get a test back, we're looking for a number between 50 and 200. And when I get a test back and somebody's 17 or 24, you know, they're very, very low amounts of secretory IgA, then I can build that IgA with a supplement called glutamine. L-glutamine. Remember, there's an L in front of anything that's an amino acid. So you've got an L and a hyphen and then the word glutamine. Glutamine is considered to be a conditionally essential amino acid. You know, there are two families of amino acids, essential and non-essential. Essential was a word that is used in nutrition that means that it has to come from your plate. Essential doesn't mean you need it. Essential means it's got to come off the plate. Non-essential doesn't mean you don't need it. It just means your body can make it. But a third category has been created, which is conditionally essential, so that when somebody's in a challenge situation, then under those conditions, a non-essential amino acid becomes an essential amino acid. And glutamine is an example of that. Glutamine is the preferred fuel of the colonocytes, the cells that line the digestive tract. And so when we use glutamine as a supplement, I call it bowel spackle. I call it bowel spackle because it helps to close up those, quote, holes that are created, whether they were created by celiac or any kind of ulceration in the bowel, or whether they were created because somebody was taking narcotics for a period of time after their back surgery, or they had a bad food poisoning, or they got a lousy intestinal flu, any of those kinds of things, glutamine can help restore the integrity of the gut. So again, let's stack up the priority of these things. One, we're looking at probiotics to go into the bowel. You know, we're looking at digestive enzymes. We're looking at IgGs. Well, to support IgAs, we use glutamine. And I prefer the powdered glutamine because it's a whole lot cheaper than the capsules. And I might use a teaspoon a meal just stirred into a yogurt, stirred into water, stirred into fruit juice. It could be mixed with anything cold. And it may be a short-lived remedy. Somebody may only need to be on glutamine for a month in order to heal up the gut wall if they've stopped doing the thing that injures it. So there's a lot of action steps that you can take for IBS even when you don't know the cause.
Glutamine is such an amazing, amazing amino acid. They have shown in a study about, I think it's about 20 years ago now, that for people that had short bowel syndrome, they had to have a huge portion of their small bowel removed surgically. They actually were malabsorbing because they had not enough bowel to absorb. They were on IV nutrition to live, period. It was the only way they could survive. But a creative doctor and nutritionist got together and used growth hormone and glutamine and actually grew bowel in these patients. They actually extended the bowel by feet and eliminated their need for intravenous food. They were able to eat oral again and absorb.
Astounding. Astounding. Dr. Fred Harvey, internist and geriatrician, and my guest here on No Nonsense Nutrition. Thanks for your insight about the gut, Dr. Harvey.
Thank you for having me.